Bill Hanson's my name. I joined the Royal Australian Artillery in 1962. Well, actually, a cadet to start with in 1962. Done a core training at the School of Artillery at North Head. Then posted to 111 Battery at Holsworthy. And I stayed in that battery for the whole 6 years I was in the military, from 62 to 68 when I got out, when other things in life rather than the military.
Hello, Helen. Yes, I'm Brian Selby. I paralleled Bill, in effect. We joined the Army on the same day. We did the whole career thing together, from recruit school right through to discharge, and we are part of the Malaya and Borneo Veterans Association of Australia, South Australia and Northern Territory branch.
The 111 Battery was unique to the Australian Army post-World War II in that it was the only battery of its kind to be a field force unit from the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, my name's Theo de Kuyper. I joined the Royal Australian Navy in late 63 to 70, and I was based on the HMAS Sydney, HMAS Melbourne and the USS Enterprise. So I was an Air Fleet Air Arm armourer.
Theo, when these chaps were en route to Malaya, you were actually aboard the Sydney, and so you accompanied them from Australia to Malaya. That must have been some incredible experience.
Yes, we actually chaperoned the army, you know, looked after them. I actually gave up my hammock for them because they're good lads. I slept on a steel floor in front of my locker for the 6 weeks or so they were happy and well fed.
And you did that out of the goodness of your heart?
Yes, the kindness of my heart because of my love of the army.
I must say, Helen, that the hammocks were the most comfortable thing I've ever slept in my life. Not.
I think you tell lies.
On the Sydney, when we first boarded, it was a Sunday afternoon. We'd been housed in the various messes that we were going into and bedded down for the night, basically. And Sydney left, but the next morning we went down to breakfast, right? And honestly, the Navy did feed itself very well, but in turn, we'd never eaten so well in our lives either, I don't think. The multiple choices were wonderful. But below decks, they had these massive great fans in the mess decks, which were needed because the old Sydney had no air conditioning whatsoever. And it's in tropical waters, and it's a northern hemisphere boat, right? So ship, I'm sorry. Anyway, all the cereals there, cornflakes, wheat bix, rice bubbles. So I thought, oh, I'll try some rice bubbles. And there's a, you know, my particular area, there's about 18 blokes that were sleeping in the area that I was in. Three Charlie One, it was, Theo. Mm. Three Charlie One, mate, yeah. Starboard side. Anyway, load myself up with rice bubbles, and you go down to the next station, get your milk and sugar and whatever. As I walk past the fan, no milk, and there goes the rice bubbles. I've decorated the mess. You reckon the Navy wasn't upset about that? My heavens, they loved it. Look at that stupid bloody soldier.
That's really funny. That's the mess I just said I was in. Three Charlie Starboard.
The thing that I found in going to those mess decks, because you had to do them in sections, you'd have a time. You'd say, right, your breakfast is from 7.30 till 7.45. You had to really throw it down. But it was right above the engine room, and it was stinking hot, absolutely stinking. And when you're in the tropics, you'd have bowls of salt tablets. So you'd be throwing the meal down, and then you'd grab a handful of salt tablets. Was set down so he could get out to get some normal type weather because it was absolutely pouring out of the perspiration.
Right. I love the shower, right, because the Sydney manufactures its own water. I'd had a desalination plant on board. But we're allowed to shower once every 4 or 5 days. That was fantastic.
4 or 5 days?
Absolutely. Change your underwear as well, please. Yep.
So you wouldn't want to be damned with somebody.
Theo, you've mentioned that some interesting things happened on that trip from Australia to Malaya.
Right.
Name some of them.
Well, when we left at midnight, and most of the ship's crew wouldn't have known about it, so we left at midnight, and once we got into Queensland, north of Queensland, we started zigzagging day and night. We zigzagged until we got to Borneo, but we told because there was submarines to worry about. So I learnt my helmsman certificate in just probably in a week of being all-night shifts of an hour on, an hour off, zigzagging on the helm. So that was quite interesting for us. We're ordinary seamen at the time. They were just using us as slave labourers just to keep the aircraft carrier, you know, zigzagging day and night for a week. When you're an ordinary seaman, you're just like a slave. the leading seaman watching you and yelling at you all the time when it gets out of control, because the thing does veer off. It's called chasing the lubber's line. All of a sudden the aircraft carrier goes too far to the left and he tells you, and then you're back in line again. But it's very, very hard work. You last for about 20 minutes and you just sweat, and then they grab another young guy, comes on, and he spins it. You spin it from one right around and around. You grab it and you stop, and then you spin it right back again continually. You don't hold the wheel. The wheel's in motion the whole time.
Goodness.
So it's hard work.
It's hard to imagine that a vessel like that wouldn't have more slightly direct steering.
No, the thing was built in 1945. Even the Melbourne, the same sister ship, they had the same steering. Like nowadays, they have a steering the size of a pocket watch. You know, they don't even turn it. But in them days, the helm was about 5 foot diameter, as big as me, and you just spin it, and it's just hard work.
Mm. Brian, tell us why you would have left at midnight under these circumstances for Malaya.
Okay. Over the last 50 years, we've learned a lot of information concerning the involvement of Australia into the Indonesian confrontation. Part of the problem was the fact that it was a secret, undeclared war, and we were not told where we were going, apart from the fact that it was into Malaya. But we weren't told why at that stage. And the secrecy even got to the level of our families not being allowed to farewell us. And the same thing applied to the RAAF aircrew that were on board. And, of course, the naval ratings. We're talking about 800 crewmen from the Sydney, and then another 500 army personnel who were not allowed to be farewelled by their family. And as Theo mentioned just earlier, we did up anchor at Garden Island just before midnight, complete blackout. There were no navigation lights whatsoever. And the Sydney moved through the heads after about 2 hours steaming due east, turned left and started to head north. And up till that time, Captain Stevenson, who was the skipper of the Sydney, had no idea exactly what his destinations were until he was given the order to open his orders that he had received some time previous to let him know how he should navigate the ship.
What an incredible experience, not only for the Army aboard, but it must have been amazing for you as part of the Navy too, Theo.
Well, when you're lower ranks, you get told very little. The officers wouldn't have known, but we didn't know. We were just happy that we were going on a cruise, and no one knew why the Army and the Air Force and the helicopters and the guns and everything was there. They wouldn't tell us. But we were told later, after this trip, that Sukarno had told people, and I'm sure I think it got into the Sydney papers, that he was going to sink the Sydney. That's why it was a secrecy, and that we had no air cover. That's why it was zigzagging, because we had no air cover, because we had no bases that the Australian Air Force could operate out of. The Chief Air Marshal was going to get in touch with Philippines and say use their bases, but then he was told that they would automatically tell Indonesia, so that would blow the cover there.
True.
So I thought, well, let's just sneak out and zigzag the whole way so this Russian submarines can't get us. It'd be better chance than if we had air cover. It'd be better zigzagging than. So that was their idea at the time.
Submarines were actually Russian. Indonesia at that stage was believed to have maybe one, but in fact it was six, all Russian-made and Russian-crewed.
I could tell you what class, I think. They were Krieg-class submarines, six of them. They always had half of the East German Navy. They had all the patrol boats, gunboats, but they were very badly manned. They didn't have any technique of how to use them, so they weren't a big problem of ever trying to fight the Australian or the English Navy. They just had some of the cast-offs of the Russians and the East Germans that they give to or sold to the Indonesians, who wanted to have something while they're going to try to take Borneo back off the British.
So I think Russia was an ally of Indonesia at the time.
Well, absolutely, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just remembering you're talking to me, going, Brian, saying that going through the heads here, and black as black, turn left. And I remember we never saw land. I think it was about 3 days or 4 days. And even going up to Barrier Reef, and I think it was somewhere around the Solomon Islands or New Island.
We went between
New Island and New Britain, through there, and then up around the top of New Guinea to Manus Island before we stopped.
Mm.
And that was only a mail run, I think.
No, we played football at Manus. We beat Manus's team. Army.
Okay. So life was hard with the Army on board, Theo.
It was interesting because the SAS were doing live shooting off the back of the ship, so just shooting at beer cans and stuff, and they were using a new rifle called an SLR, was it? FN?
Or
was it an SLR?
Yeah.
Well, that's Yeah, we had still had the iron guns.
Well, we only had 303s, but the SAS were using live ammo. But the thing I noticed very quickly about it, I hadn't been in the Navy very long, but I couldn't understand how the Army was so old, because I was like 17, and I was looking at all these guys, and I was walking around, and I thought, I wanted to be in the Army, and I was looking at all these guys, but I didn't realise at the time I was looking at SAS guys, who were very senior and very strong and tough-looking men. And I was thinking, my God,
it's shoe nails and spit rust, mate.
So how old were you, Brian?
I was actually the youngest. I was 19 and 3 months.
Right, and Bill?
And I was 19, yep.
So it was an extremely young force that we were sending off to potential problems, huge problems.
Particularly our battery. The battery had a heck of a lot of young fellas.
Artillery battery, we're talking about.
Anti-aircraft.
Yeah. So did you get to do any firing practice aboard this
Yes, event? We did. We were also at, the aft? Or the back end?
The stern. Isn't that nice?
Stern.
Also, yeah, the blunt stern. End. Yeah, we had live firing. They'd send up these balloons and they'd let them out in the water and you sit up there with the Owen gun or an SLR and bang, 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 bang. It's all training sort of thing. Mm. Yeah, that went for, few days, and then you had to keep maintenance on your guns because of the sea spray and all this sort of stuff. So there was plenty going on. They sort of had to keep us actively employed.
Well, church parade every Sunday. Yeah.
Of course.
But there was a crossing a line ceremony.
Yes, we had that. That was hilarious. Yeah. That was absolutely hilarious.
That's the equator. When you cross the equator, King Neptune comes on board.
So this was your chance
it's
to
a naval tradition.
The army.
Yeah, it's a naval tradition. Yeah. They were going to teach these diggers a whole heap of stuff.
All rotten old food and rotten everything. And told the army, that's tradition. That's what you have to do.
And they got us.
They copped it.
The battery representative was a chap called John Thomas, Mouse Thomas. Right, he was the smallest chap in the battery. I don't know how he actually got in the army, really, for physical size. But he represented the battery to meet King Neptune. And this massive, great swimming pool had been set up. And the Navy do it properly. With King Neptune and his handmaidens were all set up on the deck. And Mouse was thrown into this pool. And he had to swim across the pool to shake Neptune's hand. Every time the poor little fella tried to get out, they'd shove him back in. After about half an hour, he's just about drowned, right? So they let him get out. But we all got a certificate, and Mouse never forgave us.
Yeah, that was funny.
Moral of the story, never trust the Navy.
Never trust a sailor.
That's been your service.
So, Theo, getting back to that trip and from the Navy's point of view, you mentioned something about gunboats before. What were you going to tell me about them?
We were sailing along off, I don't know whereabouts, but it was Borneo, and some gunboats come out from behind an island, I would say about three of them from a distance, and automatically the ship went full steam, and we're all watching to see what these things were doing, and one of the escort frigates with us, either Yarra or Parramatta, I forget which one, they come racing around from the stern of us and straight at these boats, and we just kept going, so they went right head on into them. So they're obviously Indonesians, but we didn't know what happened at the time, and no one told us anything. We didn't know, but years later I was talking to people about it, and they had damaged these boats. And the radio operator on the frigate was telling me this, that he got no acknowledgement of it. He was an analyst and not even allowed to talk about it. He just said it was a joke, how it was all covered up. But they damaged these boats badly and just kept going. No one heard about it.
And elements of that secrecy for the whole mission still exist to some extent today, and we'll talk about that later. Number 3 Squadron from the RAAF was located in Malaya at the time, but couldn't provide air cover for the HMAS Sydney.
There was no air cover at all. Sabres there, super Sabres.
So. But it was too far away.
Right.
So they couldn't do anything without refuelling somewhere.
They could use the Philippines.
There couldn't be a support.
The Filipinos would have told their friends in Indonesia about it. So it would have been worse being attacked by their Air Force.
Yeah, and the RAF out of Salita or
Tenga,
would not have been able to cover us because it was too far away.
Townsville had a base, Air Force base, but it wouldn't have covered, had to have land somewhere up there, there was nowhere. But they thought it was a smart idea when you read the report on it and that, and they thought it was safer to have two escort destroyers with us and zigzag the whole way as fast and have other ships, like there was supposed to be an American or Australian submarine shadowing us, but we didn't know that at the time anyway. Than have some Air Force attack us.
Submarine doesn't really help when you're being attacked from the air.
We'd actually been in Malaya since, the 1950s, hadn't we?
Second World War, really.
48.
Well, 1945, the Australians were still there.
The British were there.
Yeah, the British.
But New Zealanders?
The third Battalion were in Malaya.
The Brits, when this happened. New Zealand and Australia had infantry battalions on the ground at Tarenda Garrison in Malacca.
Right.
And they had to get them somehow. And there was no ships to get them back over to Borneo. So actually, there was minesweepers that belonged to the British, or things lying around, and they actually used New Zealand Navy guys who volunteered to man these little minesweepers just to send them down off the coast of Kuching and that, just as their presence to put the Indonesians off. So they weren't prepared for any of this. You know, the British weren't prepared at all for it.
Now, when you arrived in Malaya, you mentioned about the Governor-General leaving.
Yeah, well, he had left before, and he left off the wharf that we actually pulled into, and it's still a very old wharf, battered old wharf sitting there, and it's like a memorial thing because it's a 22-storey building right next to it. Before it was just all jungle, so it has changed a lot. But it was interesting to know that he had left there in all his full regalia and everything, and we've got the photos of him leaving, but that was a few months just before we got there.
And the purpose of his leaving?
The British gave it back to the Borneo Company, Malaysia. It was going to become Malaya. Before that, it was British North Borneo. So the Malaysians were taking it over because they owned Singapore at the time before Lee Kuan Yew took it off them.
We'll come back to your naval service, Theo, because you have some interesting tales to tell about your time afterwards when you were transferred to the HMAS Melbourne.
Oh, the Melbourne, yeah. I was on the Melbourne when it collided and cut the USS Frankie Evans in halves in the South China Sea off Vietnam at 3 o'clock one morning. It was getting ready to do flying, and they told the Evans to come around to do escort right behind the ship in case the plane crashed or something, and they'd pick him up. But it veered off and cut in front of us. At the time, the captain of the Evans was asleep, you know, which is legal, but the young guy in charge was a 23-year-old lieutenant, and he just got it wrong. He turned too hard to starboard and come straight at us, and the Melbourne couldn't turn it. We already knew a minute before it even happened. They were on the intercom telling us standby for collision stations, but the Melbourne, all it could do was just, it was going flat out backwards when it hit it, but it still cut it in halves and sank it.
Yeah. It was a great loss of life.
Oh, yeah.
Were there many injuries aboard the Melbourne itself?
No, only people that got smashed on the stairs, running upstairs, steel stairs when it hit. But nothing happened to the Melbourne. Smashed the bow. And the one really good thing that Captain Stevens will tell you about is that they'd smashed the bow in and went right through the cells and it came to about the second deck. And a lot of people, I've lived in 3 Charlie Starboard, which is 3 rows back from the bow, but it didn't worry us. But the captain, he came on straight after this happened. We were all sitting there safe, and he said that we were quite lucky, and he had never spoke to us at the time I've ever seen. He'd come and put the whole ship's company in the hangars and talk to us, and he said that a big split appeared from that collision. It came right back to within 11 feet of where their fuel was, and it would have blown the ship to smithereens. We would have never found the ship. And there's even a better story that back before this was on the Melbourne, a lady who's supposed to see into the future, every year in Sydney she would tell you what was going to happen next year, and she had done some research because the Melbourne had taken on aircraft called A4E Skyhawks off their old Sea Venoms, and they used a lot more high volatile fuel, and they made huge tanks on it, and the thing was full of, but she somehow said, oh, the Melbourne will burn to the waterline during the year. This happened in June that year. I mean, it was nothing, but it was just funny that she thought that, but it came within 11 feet of hitting that thousands of gallons of aviation fuel.
Wow.
I just remember that. It's a joke. Yeah, I can't even remember, but that was 69. Yeah.
That would have laid the Melbourne up for quite a while then for repairs.
Yeah, we were in Singapore for 2 months. It was brilliant because we flew our squadrons for ashore and were based at Tenga, and we lived with the English, and it was really good life.
The Melbourne was absolved of all blame in regard to that?
But the thing is that the Americans wanted to do something about it, so they got the captain of the Melbourne to appear in a inquiry in Subic the Philippines, Subic Bay, which is an American base, and he was innocent straight away because the admiral of our fleet was in the bridge of the Melbourne at the time, so the two most senior guys we've got, and they were there. But by him even having to appear there, that ruined his chance of going from captain. His next jump was he would have been admiral. So when that happened, he quit the Navy. And his wife was a famous TV star at the time, and she really put up a good show on the TV and stuff about it. But, yeah, it just ruined his chances for promotion, so he left the Navy.
That doesn't seem fair, if he was absolved of all guilt. Mm.
It's just that he did appear before one, see, so it's...
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
the Navy mud sticks.
Well, I hope that sort of attitude has changed now. The world has changed to a great degree, and hopefully that's one of the areas that, that have.
Well, the Australian Navy was modelled off the British Navy, and it was very, very hard discipline, and that's why it made the British so famous, the discipline.
Well, they used to keel haul them too, Theo, but no, they don't do that now. No.
I had it done a couple of times, that's all. On an aircraft carrier, it's hard.
Hard or difficult? Okay. So what else we
you
got?
You're fantastic. You are.
Okay.
Helen, what are we going to do with you?
So we'll all come down. Now, Theo, when you arrived in Malaya, where did you arrive at, and what happened when you had to get rid of all of these army bods off the ship?
Well, we played a game of football against the Butterworth. And it was so hot, it was on the equator, and they had buckets of ice all around the oval, and people were just about fainting everywhere, but it was incredible. The game between the Army and Navy, I mean, the Navy played the Air Force and the Army, so that's the best thing I remember. But we drove around in trucks all around, dropping their supplies off and everything. We liked it because we sat in the back of these trucks and dropped off all their stuff, you know, like labourers, you know. Like slave, they use us for slave labour again. The army guys would have been sitting back under the umbrellas.
They were preparing for battle. So, Theo, what was the name of the port that you landed at?
Yeah. We didn't land at Butterworth. We landed at Penang. So we're
at they anchored, anchored between Georgetown and Butterworth. Everything was offloaded, except the helicopters. Of course, they were flown off for Fire Squadron, but everything else had to be offloaded onto barges and put on the beach adjacent to RAF Base Butterworth.
We went on army ducks backwards and forwards.
They felt as though they really were in it then, in the army ducks. My heavens, they really did appreciate how good
it was. Very tough.
Oh, how good it was.
So you dropped the army off, and where did the Sydney go from there?
Went home.
Yeah, went back around the coast, back to Perth, and then back to Melbourne, and then back to Sydney.
Did you bring any more troops over
that? It wasn't actually called a troop ship in them days. It became a troop ship after that when it took the 1st Battalion over in 1965. Well, I went on to the Melbourne with the Fleet Air Arm with the squadrons, you know, two times, and then I finished up on the American aircraft carrier. They swapped us with Americans, you know, swap over just to see that our A4Es could land on one of their carriers, which is okay, but that was quite interesting.
Okay, so you've dropped the army off in Malaya. Brian and Bill, tell us about what happened when you left the ship. Do you want to start off, Bill?
Yeah.
It was hot.
Stinking
hot.
It was stinking hot. It was. It was incredible, the heat. It's the humidity more than anything, so much the heat. I mean, it was about 110 in the shade. When it was that blistering. It was terrible. But anyway, we were part of the sort of the unloading side of it to get the stuff onto the trucks, which would take us back to Butterworth, offload it there over a period of,
about 12 hours.
Yeah, 12 hours, was it? I think it was, 12, 14 hours it took to unload the ship.
Yeah, we had 3 months' worth of stores and ammo.
Ammunition, that's right. And the other thing was, too, that we got into was that to drive the Air Force trucks, you had to be licensed, even though you were licensed to tow guns. Right, and I was licensed to tow a gun, and you had to go through the Air Force, and they used to teach you how to reverse a tanker. You'd be alongside a ramp, and you had to back this tanker around and back up the ramp before they'd actually give you a license. And I thought, gee, this is hard. But by the time that 14 hours was up, I think it was the next, I think Brian might correct me, about a couple of weeks or something before we started really settling in.
Yeah, they gave us 2 weeks of acclimatisation.
Yeah.
And issue of tropical gear. When we left Australia, we were in Australian pattern uniforms, which were totally different to what we would wear. And we ended up being issued with British tropical gear, which was very, very good stuff, including the boots. And we had a couple of weeks of that. The primary task after we were offloaded was simply to plot where the guns would be placed around the base, and of course the OPs, which Bill and I were.
And an OP is
an observation post. Mine was 11 Echo, or Echo OP, about 8,000 yards north of the base, outside the perimeter. And what were you on, Bill?
I was on the one on at Mookahead Lighthouse on Penang.
Yep.
It's covered the sort of the northwest area because we had an arc out there each time.
Yeah, bearing in mind that we're at the closest point, we're only 12 miles across the water from Sumatra. So it wasn't difficult for them to get up and be there very quickly.
There was no exaggeration of the danger of the situation. Indonesian troops actually had parachuted in.
Oh, yeah, and they landed on the west coast.
Yeah, they landed on the beaches at Penang.
Yeah, they came through, no doubt about that. So, yeah, there was close contact down the coast, mostly around Malacca and Selangor, places like that, which were very easy to get across in fishing boats and what have you. They weren't coming across in recognisable naval ships. They were coming across in your normal old fishing boat, armed to the teeth. But other than that, the paras did drop in. They tried that once, but it wasn't successful.
When I first got to Borneo, I was sunburnt very badly because we took our shirts off to work on the trucks and ammo and everything. And I had finished up with big lumps, blisters that big on my arm and shoulder, and I had to keep out of the sun, which is... You get charged if you get sunburnt. You know, you're not supposed to do it. But anyway, by the time I'd got to Butterworth and everything, I'd been burnt so badly. And I've been operated on it ever since. For skin cancer, I've been operated on probably 25 times in the last 20 years. There's skin cancer just broke out there, there.
I don't know why they put your head on back to front, though, mate. Why'd they do that?
And that was just because there was no such thing as sunscreen. And no one said, don't stand on the sun, because we were white. Red hair with white. And
I can remember Ken Matthews, who was in 3 Battalion and served in Malaya. He said that the New Zealanders used to call the Aussies milk bottle because they were so white.
That's right. Well, I'm from Port Macdonald, where it's never hadn't seen the sun for years. And you go straight into Borneo, which is on the equator, and then Singapore is on the equator, Malacca. So we just got burnt to pieces by the sun.
Army blokes didn't do that, though.
Yeah.
The Brits were pretty white too.
They stood out.
I can imagine the problems from skin cancer suffered from the majority of the men on those missions.
It's an automatic.
They keep cutting it out of you all the time. I have to go in for this again. Just they'll cut it out, and then another few months it'll come out, but it just grows everywhere.
You don't have to prove that you have it now. Keratosis is an accepted ailment through Department of Veterans Affairs. But as I said a couple of minutes ago, Theo, why did they put your head on back to front, mate?
Isn't he rude?
We'll cut that. That won't be. No one will hear that.
He thinks he's still aboard the Sydney sleeping in your hammock.
He thinks he's in the Navy.
While you're sleeping on the floor.
I go to a dermatologist every 6 months. Yeah. Same thing. And I say to my dermatologist, am I still on the weight loss program? There's a bit going off here and a bit going off there. He has a laugh. That's just part and parcel of being in the military or the Navy, the Air Force, mostly the Navy and the Army. We've all got it. We've got skin cancers of some sort.
What strikes me today about you three sitting there talking to me about you, your service and the times, which really were quite drastic times, is the mateships that you all seem to enjoy. Mm. You went through some tough times. You laugh about it. Mm. But you're good mates and you're able to laugh about it and share your memories.
We do that. I mean, because once you get out of the military or the Navy or whatever, you finish up, you're spread all over the country, right? Unless you keep personal contact with people you've actually served with, you lose contact after a period of time. Now, Brian, myself, as I say, we served together in the same unit for 6 years. After I got married here in Adelaide and then had my family, I had nothing to do with the military at all. For the first 10, 15 years, that's just the way it was with a lot of people. You have families first, you tend to your families, and then once that's sorted out, then you can start coming back, and which I did with Brian. And we've got a lot of ex-111 battery people here in Adelaide. We've got a lot of 111 battery people in Queensland. They're probably about those two places, aren't they, Brian?
I reckon between the two cities we could muster the command post and probably a gun troop. And one of the blokes that was wanted to be here today, of course, is Roger Berzicott, Buzz. Unfortunately, he can't be here today with us, but he has a great membership responsibility as well. In that the older we're getting, the more important it is becoming, Helen. You know, just our battery, out of the 180 men of all corps that were on the ground in 1964... Over 70 now have passed away. That's apart from the casualties we had there. That's more than a third of the battery have gone, which is incredible.
It is. You've recently been back there for a reunion. Talk about that.
Well, 50 years, right? 50 years in the making, 2 years in the planning, and about an hour for the service. But it was absolutely wonderful, Helen. Theo actually came along as the RAN representative. And we had a week of reconnecting with the locals up there and confirming different things that we wanted to reconnect with. I must say that the people of Kuching and the Bao District are so appreciative of what was done by the Australians and the New Zealanders and the Brits to a certain level, but Australian troops were primarily the area in the Bao District. They know their history extremely well, and particularly the children. We have three adopted schools in the Bao District at Sarikan, Subawan and Stas, and they, in their own way, put on a welcoming committee for us of the whole village, each one of the kampongs, and it was overwhelming the way that they made us feel so warm, and if though it was stinking hot, it was really good to be there. And as a result of that, we've got some very good continuation that will occur now for as long as we live. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And a memorial plaque was erected.
First one outside of Australia, believe it or not. We have no memorials to either of the post-World War II campaigns in Malaya. But this is...
You mean in Australia?
In Australia, nothing in Australia at all, right? The people of Sarawak and Malaysia have a totally different attitude towards it. And the memorial tablet that we were able to place in the Kuching War Memorial Gardens lists the members of the Australian Army and one RAAF member who died on operational service during the confrontation. And they made it such a service that the chief of their infantry divisions laid a wreath on behalf of us and their men. We had the Borneo Scouts and Iban Trackers Association and over 100 former Malaysian Army personnel who worked with the Australians for the service. We had 36 Australians on the ground, mostly from 4 Battalion, believe it or not, some from 3 and 111 battery members. And believe it or not, we were only the second to be allowed to place a memorial. The other was from the SAS, the Australian SAS, who mounted their tablet in August 2015. And it's doubtful that anyone else will be allowed to place a memorial in that area. That's how much they respect the Australian Defence Forces.
That's an amazing amount of support for Australia and what Australia did in those years.
Oh, my word. You know, it starts from the highest level of the government in Sarawak, which goes through to the Agong or the King up in KL. You know, they know their history and they want to be part of the commemoration of what happened to their country.
Mm-hmm. Post-World War II, the Malayan Emergency and the Indonesian confrontation are the only two campaigns that Australia has been involved in that were complete victories. Not one inch of territory was lost, and there are no demarcation lines on the maps. All right? That's taking nothing away from what happened in Vietnam, of course, or Korea. Korea is still a live situation, believe it or not. There's no declaration of peace there at all. Vietnam, we pulled out graciously, of course.
What would you like to see happen in Australia in regard to recognition for the period?
Heavens, you know, Bill and I have been working on this for decades.
Where do you
start? Memorial. Memorial in Canberra. Every other conflict, starting from the Boer War, has a memorial in Canberra, right? Whether it be on the avenue or in the grounds of the Australian War Memorial. There's nothing for the two post-World War campaigns on the Malayan Peninsula and in Borneo. The politics of the era still pervade the whole thing. It's unfortunate, but you know, it did happen. We were there, and we did lose men.
Mm. The other thing is, too, as Brian said, the politics of that whole thing, to get a plaque or a memorial erected in Canberra, it's like pulling eye teeth. And even so, if we wanted to have something like that there, we're the ones that have to come up with the money. You know, I mean, this is the Australian people, the government, you know, they sent us over there in the first place, right, and give us no recognition whatsoever.
Yeah, Bob Menzies was the Prime Minister at the time, and he was reluctant to do it, but obviously pressure from the UK made the decision for him and New Zealand to be there. And the degree of difficulty is that it gets acknowledged from time to time by the incumbent Minister for Veterans Affairs, but that's as far as it goes.
That's exactly
and the latest figure that's been thrown around to get a memorial erected is something like $700,000. But there's no guarantee from the Australian government that it will occur anyway. Right? They won't even donate the plot of earth in the avenue.
By the avenue, we're talking about the avenue that leads up to the Australian War Memorial.
That's right. Yeah.
Where everyone else is commemorated.
That's right. Yes. Where everyone else is, including the latest campaigns and the peacekeepers. They have theirs, which is great, absolutely wonderful. But for some reason, post-World War II Malaya just doesn't get a mention.
Could it be that while you were fighting the Indonesians or warding off the Indonesians in Malaya, we were actually training their officers here in Australia?
Don't dream.
Isn't that...
that was smart.
That's a fact. School of Artillery, School of Infantry, School of Engineers were actually training Indonesians in tactics, which were
used against us.
Yep.
Give me a break.
So, Remembrance Day coming up. 11th of November is not very far away, in a couple of days. What's happening with the Malaya Borneo Veterans Association for Remembrance Day?
I'll be on that. I spoke to you earlier about the reunion we've got in Canberra between 111 Battery, 110 Battery. I'll be probably on the end of that, just coming probably back home, but I won't be home for that date. So really there may be something over there in Canberra, but I've got something organised. I really don't know at this stage until we get there.
Brian?
Well, I've got my mate here, the Matlow, Admirali.
And
he's going to be with me.
For listeners, if they don't know what a matelot is?
A matelot, it's the French term for saleur. Or Jim Hawkins, it's your turn in the barrel, Jim. Sorry about that. We're going to be the Hilton War Memorial, closely followed by some soothing beverage at the Plimpton Glenelg RSL.
Excellent. You looking forward to that, Theo?
Yes, and I'm very pleased that you'll be donating towards this. It comes as a surprise, but I'm very happy about it.
You're welcome, Theo. After all, how much could a pie with sauce and a glass of water cost? Well, it's been a great pleasure talking to you three chaps today about those memories that probably only seem like 15 years ago, but it's a long time.
53 years ago. Mm.
Thank you very much for coming in today, Bill and Brian.
Thank
and
you, Helen.
Theo.
I can't believe it. 53?
Yeah.
No.
It was 64.
64, was it?
64.
Yeah, 64.
That's right.
52.
52 years, yeah. Mm. I'll do the maths for you.